wanna smash, crash, blast, smash, blast the system. We wanna get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, fist pumping, rhythm is hitting.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we get an update on the case of Julian Assange. We'll be joined by journalist Kevin Gostola of Shadowproof.com. He'll give us an update on the Assange ruling against extradition, as well as his denial of bail. Later in the program, we are joined by Michael D. Knox. He's the force behind the U.S. Peace Memorial Foundation. Recent 2021 edition of Ending U.S. Wars by Honoring Americans Who Worked for Peace will be the topic of our conversation, which features the U.S. Peace Registry, as well as a list of U.S. Peace Prize winners, including the most recent recipient. Stay with us on the Project Censored Show.
Unthinkable crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of today's program, we welcome back Kevin Gostola. He's the managing editor at Shadowproof, shadowproof.com. He produces and co-hosts the weekly podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. Kevin Gostola, multiple-time winner of Project Censored Awards for his stellar reporting, a lot of it about whistleblowers. And of course, today we welcome Kevin Gostola back to the Project Censored Show to talk about the historic case against Julian Assange. Kevin Gostola, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Hey, thanks. It's really good to talk to you, Mickey.
Kevin, thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule. Really quickly at the outset here, even though we have other plans, what happened in the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. is certainly something that took over the media airwaves, this elephant in the room that we can't necessarily ignore. Just very quickly, your thoughts about the media spectacle that was this so-called insurrection against the Capitol.
To me, this was obviously predictable just because we had GOP lawmakers and we have this right-wing media echo chamber that was pumping out drivel for, you could say, the last 3 months, but what if we said at least the last 2 to 3 years about Donald Trump and about the government and the lengths to which institutions were going to go to ensure that he did not win re-election. And so naturally you saw a mob of people descend, especially when he sent them to Capitol Hill. And what frustrated me in terms of media malpractice, everything that I do when I'm covering the Assange case inevitably ends up running into some kind of shameful act on the part of the media when it comes to that case. And so the media malpractice, I think, was I'm watching CNN because that's my window into it. I'm not in Washington, D.C. I couldn't be down there to see with my very own eyes. And I didn't have a good live stream handy that I was viewing. So I'm watching CNN and I hear Dana Bash very inartfully and generally describe everyone there as anarchists. And I thought, this is why this is a terrible way to cover what's going on at the Capitol building. They organized a rally called Stop the Steal. Tell us, who are the people who sponsored this rally? Tell us who was there. Who paid money? I mean, when you have a rally, you have to get permits. You need to have the sound equipment. I'm familiar with what activists have to go through to organize these kind of events. You get politicians who sign on and want to be there. You have elite figures who want to participate. Who are the supporters? Who are the groups that told people to mobilize and go to the Capitol Hill building? And it wasn't until like they were dispersing that I finally heard one correspondent mention that the Oath Keepers were present. But that was the first time I heard them color in who could be the different kinds of people that were there, which I think we really need to understand in order to process what took place.
Well said. And again, I was incensed by the erroneous usage of terms like anarchist. And we see these sloppy labels thrown around all the time. There is actually an article that a friend of ours, colleague of ours, Project Censored, Steve Masick, shared with me from Forward publication, Forward.com, a guide to extremists and hate groups that invaded the Capitol. And it lists a whole series of people that have been positively identified. It lists their organizations. But I didn't hear any of this in any of the news coverage. And again, of course, you're no stranger to this because you've seen a lot of misinformation, disinformation, sloppy language around the Assange case and certainly WikiLeaks in general, going all the way back to Chelsea Manning. So this kind of media distortion is unfortunately par for the course. And Kevin Gostola, I thank you for sharing your reflections on what happened in the Capitol. One of the things that this sensationalist spectacle-like coverage of media of what happened at the Capitol, one of the consequences of that kind of coverage as propaganda is that it also pushes very significant, important stories out of the limelight. It pushes them out of the frame and into the margins. And of course, Julian Assange's case hasn't been getting covered much in the corporate press in the U.S. anyway. Now we're sure, based on the spectacle of the other day, that this isn't going to be getting much attention, I don't believe. But Kevin Gostola, tell us about the very significant updates that came from this proceeding in England.
I have two perspectives about how this unfolded, because he was denied bail, but then the extradition request was denied by the judge 2 days before, and we can get into all of this, but naturally you have other parts of the world that are grappling with what it means that a journalist was nearly extradited to the United States, but yet they're keeping him in prison during, by the way, I don't know if I should call it a second wave, but a major escalation in the COVID-19 pandemic in London. It's under lockdown, and there is an outbreak that has been acknowledged by authorities at Belmarsh in the very wing of the prison where Julian Assange is being confined. And yet he was not permitted to be released into house arrest. And so this is something I was covering. I had the ability to cover this remotely from the United States. So I wasn't in London, just to be clear with your listeners. And I followed this very intensely, as I have through every stage of the extradition proceedings that really started back in February of 2020 with legal argument. Then we had the witnesses providing testimony during a trial in September, which I talked to you about. And then now we finally had this decision. And ultimately what the judge said, just to be clear here and get this out, is if Julian Assange were to be extradited to the United States mass incarceration system would produce consequences that would ultimately lead to Julian Assange succeeding in committing suicide because of his mental health problems that he has developed as a result of the psychological torment or torture that he has endured over the last decade under arbitrary detention.
And somehow that's not happening in the UK, where he is also being locked up in a COVID ward.
I am struggling to hold back my laughter, yeah. Because you're hitting on something that's important, because it seems to be, and if you're British, you would take us to account for getting carried away here and thinking that the United States is far more abusive than the UK. You would cut in and you would say, actually, here we are having our own decline in the way that we treat our own prisoners. So don't think you are exceptional in America and have the market cornered on brutality. No. You raise a good point, because the judge talked about this as if Belmarsh High Security Prison, which has been referred to as a kind of British Gitmo, it's where they send people who are suspected of terrorism offenses. She held it up as a kind of model. And yet one example that I frequently cite is the fact that just in the past months, there was a friend, someone who Julian Assange befriended in Belmarsh, who committed suicide. He was a gay Brazilian who did not want to be deported by the UK government back to Jair Bolsonaro's Brazil. And so he killed himself in Belmarsh. Somehow we're to believe that Belmarsh is a much better facility than any of the facilities that Julian Assange would be sent to. Under lockdown conditions, he's held in a kind of confinement that amounts to solitary or isolation, because he's not allowed any social visits. And he's had to complain. His fiance Stella Morris has had to complain about the cold during winter and demand that the prison staff get him warm clothing. So it's impossible to really believe that they're that much better than the U.S. However, you know, the documentation of the Supermax prison, ADX Florence, where the judge believed Julian Assange should be sent after trial, there's a lot of horror stories that we could get into just specifically about that facility.
Kevin Gostola, this case, of course, that's been going on. I mean, again, there was just, you know, rich irony there. I would suggest, I think you'd agree that the fact that he is not being extradited is a good thing. But I think that there was some initial optimism around that that really overshot what's actually taking place with Assange, because after that, he was denied bail, correct?
Yeah, the optimism to me, I think, wasn't misplaced, because people believed that for the grounds that the judge ruled, that would likely mean he could walk free when he applied for bail. Because typically, if somebody is told that they can't be extradited for mental health reasons, it makes no sense to keep them in prison. That's just going to make it worse on an individual. You're saying somebody's health is such that confinement will actually make it worse for them. What I think some lost sight of was the fact that at its core, and every single day of this, it has always been a political case. And in a political case, there aren't going to be things that add up and make sense necessarily. And so that's how you get a kind of illogical chain of events, where a judge denies an extradition request, but then refuses to let Julian Assange leave prison until the U.S. has completed its appeal.
And Kevin Gostola, you write at shadowproof.com, recent article, British judge keeps Assange in prison despite ruling against extradition. You quote Judge Vanessa Beritzer saying, quote, as far as Mr. Assange is concerned, this case has not been won. And she said the United States government, quote, must be allowed to challenge her decision. She's referring to the appeal. And then I'm assuming that this is why he's denied bail, because they are claiming he's a flight risk. That's correct?
Yes. I can outline some of these reasons. And if we think about journalists who are pursued and jailed around the world and don't deserve this kind of persecution, I think it ought to bring some heaviness to our conversation, because they offered to put a GPS tracking device on Julian Assange and place him under house arrest. At no point during these bail proceedings does she ever explain how she believes Julian Assange is going to escape and how she believes he's going to make his way from whatever address. I presume it's going to be somewhat remote. I would think it would be in a kind of London suburb, though I don't have the address and I understand why that wasn't disclosed. But we all remember the spectacle. You talk about spectacles. We all remember the spectacle that the UK government created around the Ecuador embassy by lining cops up along the Ecuador embassy building. We saw cops up in the stairwells. We saw how they had it under 24/7 watch. Does anyone really think Julian Assange is going to make it out of the home that he is under house arrest and flee without anyone there knowing, let alone UK security agents being there on guard? So there is no good reason why he couldn't be on house arrest with a tracker. That would have been enough to prevent any kind of absconding. What it comes down to is a kind of latent prejudice that right. exists in the mind of this judge and the entire system of the British government that is serving the interests every step of the way of the U.S. government. You know, they are working as a kind of client state for the U.S. government in carrying out this extradition case for the Justice Department. And the other thing that she's focused on and was swayed by is the prosecutor came in there and said, WikiLeaks assisted NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden in leaving Hong Kong. And they use this to say that if Julian Assange is let out of Belmarsh, his huge networks of supporters, this is what the prosecutor said, would be able to help him do the same thing again. And they're worried that he would go to an embassy and then he would be able to fly and leave. That to me is just another example of the criminalization of journalism, because how I understand Edward Snowden, especially at this moment in our history, is that he released documents that exposed mass surveillance that formed major investigative journalistic pieces that received awards. And all these journalists that published the material, they have accolades. Their careers are doing pretty well. And meanwhile, Edward Snowden remains in exile in Moscow. What WikiLeaks did was help a source. They helped a source get to safety. And I don't think that's irresponsible of journalists to do, because you sort of have a source protection obligation when you're engaged in this work.
So I want to get to that, but right now we have to take a brief break. I'd like to remind listeners, you're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We're speaking with Kevin Gostola, a journalist, also managing editor of Shadowproof, shadowproof.com. He produces and co-hosts the weekly podcast, Unauthorized Disclosure, and has been covering the case of Julian Assange. We'll continue our conversation after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, in this segment, we're speaking with Kevin Gostola, independent journalist, managing editor of Shadowproof, shadowproof.com. He produces and co-hosts the weekly podcast, Unauthorized Disclosure. Kevin Gostola is no stranger to the Project Censored Show and audience, is a stellar journalist that specifically covers a lot of whistleblower issues, was on the front lines covering the Chelsea Manning case and, of course, Edward Snowden. And now we're talking about Julian Assange, some recent updates on the case coming out of the UK. Before the break, Kevin, you were reminding us as to, well, what exactly is the political show trial in Britain about regarding Julian Assange? Why have the establishment of so many countries been out to get Julian Assange for so long? WikiLeaks has been around for quite a while now, and it used to be that many liberals held Assange and WikiLeaks up as heroic for leaking the collateral murder video and these types of things. What do you make of that shifting baseline there out from under Assange? And then, of course, that does tie into some of the nonsense around Russiagate and the allegations that Assange helped switch the outcome of the 2016 election for Donald Trump, which he both denied and also denied cooperating with Cambridge Analytica. Not to get too deep into that rabbit hole here, but I'm curious as to your thoughts about that whole trajectory about this public image of Assange that's clearly front and center at the trial here. You just mentioned that Assange clearly isn't a flight risk, yet the judge there is continuing to punish him.
I don't know if that necessarily has to do with political ideology. It might be more to do with her identification with people within the security state and the sort of way in which she views the common criminal and how they can outsmart law enforcement. This is just a typical way that people who are judges tend to think. If they think more like prosecutors than defense attorneys, then naturally they're not going to let somebody out on bail. But to what you're saying, to me, we just see confirmation of the analysis put forward by UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Niels Meltzer, who is clearly documented in his report going over the Swedish investigation that ultimately kicked off this extradition saga back in 2010. We see in his report details of the psychological torture endured in the Ecuador embassy. And then accompanying that, and you can't separate it, is the character assassination as well as the public mobbing against Assange that unfolds over the last decade. And it does shift politically. It starts in 2010 with the right wing, with some support from figures like Joe Biden and other Democrats, but for the most part, the anger is directed from Fox News and other conservative voices who are appalled that U.S. military documents have been exposed and that torture and war crimes are seeing the light of day and that the military and the State Department are under scrutiny. But nonetheless, Hillary Clinton is upset as the Secretary of State, etc. But then as we get to the 2016 election and they publish Clinton campaign emails, it becomes this idea that they're somehow serving the interests of the Trump campaign. And if you listen to some of the Clinton Democrats, the narrative they'll spout is that the Access Hollywood tape was being published. And in order to make sure that that didn't have the impact it did, and we didn't focus on Trump's actions, WikiLeaks swooped in and started publishing Clinton campaign emails in order to distract us. And all of this is to say that there's been a lot of propaganda out there from political elites to lead people, especially liberal-minded, especially Democratic voters, into believing that Julian Assange cozied up to the Trump administration. And he may deserve this. And it's sort of like karmic. I think that's a false way of looking at it, simply because we have evidence that there was at least an informal offer made by a congressional representative to extend a pardon on behalf of Donald Trump. And Julian Assange refused it. And it was around Russiagate. You know, the offer was put forward to Julian Assange while he was in the embassy, allegedly, that if you could give us any information about the source of the emails in this Russiagate or this Russia investigation, then there might be a pardon for you. There would likely be a pardon for you, and you could walk free. And he said, look, I have principles here at WikiLeaks. We don't expose our confidential sources, and that would damage our reputation. So no, I am not going to help Donald Trump. And to him, he recognized that that likely infuriated Donald Trump.
So Kevin Gastola, the other thing that comes up, I hate to bring this up, but I just want to quickly address it just to get your views of it and remind folks, because this has been circulating when I was reading about the stuff going on and posting about it at Project Censored, because we certainly think the Assange case has a lot to do with the future of journalism and press freedom. But a lot of folks, particularly more on the liberal end of the spectrum, keep bringing up the extradition roots and the allegations of rape and sexual assault and these type things that have basically fallen to the wayside. Could you encapsulate that narrative?
So my position on this is that the Swedish government failed these women because of the way that they handled the investigation. You know, it's possible if you are a progressive to be upset here and think that Julian Assange escaped justice. And the people you should hold responsible are the Swedish authorities that were obviously being used by the US government. I think you're left with two conclusions to draw when you look at what happened, because I kid you not, they started and stopped and started and stopped and started and stopped the investigation. That's three times, at least three times, they opened and reopened the investigation. So logically, we can only think two things, I think. Well, there's probably other ways you could think of it, but these are the two things that I focus on. It could either be that you were told to just keep the investigation open and serve the US government by keeping Julian Assange in limbo. Certainly, that's what his supporters believe. That was all about keeping him tied up while the United States government pieced together a case that they could later bring, much like the one that we're seeing and talking about here today. Or they simply violated the due process rights of Julian Assange at every turn, and they failed to appropriately act in a timely manner on the allegations. And the Swedish prosecution authority is one that should be held accountable for its missteps and its fumblings of this investigation.
Thank you for that quick assessment and overview, Kevin Gastola. The reason I bring it up is because it's the go-to red herring that turns into the ad hominem about Assange that, in my view, takes the attention away from WikiLeaks and its connection to what it means for press freedom, for protection of sources, for having access to significant documents the public has a right to see and know about. And that's why I want to come back here full circle. The reason that this case is so important and its implications for press freedom. So your comments in that regard and how you see this moving forward.
So yes, there's reason for optimism because the judge ruled against the extradition request. However, 90 to 95% of her ruling embraced almost every single allegation that was ever put forward, every scurrilous claim that was ever uttered in that magistrate court against Julian Assange, saying he's not a journalist. He was involved in criminal activity when he was in communication with Chelsea Manning, saying that his actions went outside the traditional mode of investigative journalism, saying that WikiLeaks is in fact a criminal enterprise that's in the business of hacking, not engaged in standard news gathering practices. And so it's kind of ironic to me, Julian Assange is likely to survive this extradition case. He's likely to make it out without ending up in the United States simply because it's only about the prison system. So it doesn't have anything to do with the Espionage Act in the United States. And yet this is going to be a precedent in the district court. And she's basically giving a green light to the United States government to bring future cases against publishers who challenge the U.S. government by publishing military documents, CIA documents, any kind of national security documents. The irony here is that journalists have refused to show solidarity to Julian Assange throughout this entire case for the most part. You could say right up until a week before this decision was expected to be handed down, we heard almost nothing. That was when you started to see a flurry from The Guardian, New York Times, some of these other publications suddenly had op-eds condemning the case. It was a little too late, yeah. I think. It was way too late for them to come forward. And what's the outcome? What did they do to themselves? I think they made it almost a virtual certainty that they are going to be faced in the future with correspondents who will end up in the crosshairs of the U.S. Justice Department. And meanwhile, Julian Assange is likely to survive this case.
So do you see his case ending with a whimper rather than a bang, with the larger, more draconian implications moving forward? What you just laid out is not a pretty picture for journalism.
You raise a good point here, because we don't know what kind of priority the Justice Department under Joe Biden is going to place this. We don't know where they're going to go. We would presume that if the U.S. government is appealing before Joe Biden takes office, that they're going to pick up right where the Trump administration left off and continue. But Zachary Terwilliger, who is in the Justice Department, high ranking, said something to the effect of, it's unclear what kind of resources and energy the Justice Department might want to put into this. They could take this appeal seriously. They could fight it. They could try to salvage it. Or they could just let it end in the way that I expect it to kind of end. And then Julian Assange just remains in legal limbo, which is, of course, what the CIA wants. We've seen in the Stratfor documents, we've heard from the mouth of Mike Pompeo what the goal is. It's to keep WikiLeaks and Assange tied up in these sorts of legal cases. So I think if we're talking about Julian Assange specifically, the fear is what comes after this extradition case. Once it's over, what's the next thing that they throw so that WikiLeaks and Julian Assange can't be effective anymore? I mean, unless Julian Assange says, I quit, I'm not doing this, I'm just going to be with my family, what does the U.S. government do to ensure that WikiLeaks can't be a force in journalism again? And then broadly speaking, for us, for you, for me, for everyone in this country who cares about press freedom, what are we going to do now? Because in the United Kingdom and Australia, where they haven't taken any stand against the United States, the biggest issue is that you have an erosion of freedom of information law in both of those countries. You have the national security apparatuses saying you can no longer have access to material. You have the delegitimization of media organizations. You're saying like, we're going to ban you from being part of our press lists, et cetera. Then you have cases like this, where you're going to ramp up the use of Official Secrets Act style prosecutions or Espionage Act style prosecutions to control the press. The cautionary tale here is we spent the last 2 to 3 years focusing on personality, and in the end, it's going to hamstring the press.
That's very unfortunate. It seems like we've got a lot more work to do, Kevin Gustola, and we need to remain ever vigilant. And you go a long way to help people out there really understand these issues. You're one of the few people that have been writing consistently about this going back over a decade. Kevin Gustola, managing editor, shadowproof.com. I urge you to go and read Kevin's reports and look at the work that Kevin Gustola does. Also, as producer and co-host of the weekly podcast, Unauthorized Disclosure. Kevin Gustola, as always, thank you so much for your very important work and offering your perspectives on this case and what it portends for press freedom.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. That was my conversation with Kevin Gustola of shadowproof.com. You can also follow his work at dissenter.substack.com. Up next, we'll talk about the U.S. Peace Registry, the U.S. Peace Memorial Foundation, and we'll also talk about ending U.S. wars by honoring Americans who work for peace with Dr. Michael D. Knox. Stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we are honored to welcome Dr. Michael D. Knox. We're talking about a book just released, Ending U.S. Wars by Honoring Americans Who Work for Peace. Now, this is the 2021 edition, and we're going to get into a conversation here with Michael Knox, and we're going to learn all about this. Many of you in the audience will probably know about the U.S. Peace Memorial Project, a uspeacememorial.org. While Michael Knox grew up in Michigan, earned a PhD in psychology from the University of Michigan in 1974, his academic career focused on issues of disease prevention, HIV infection, death, community mental health, and ethics. Dr. Knox authored more than 130 scholarly publications, and he was responsible for well over $50 million of research grants. Currently a fellow of American Psychological Association and Distinguished University Professor Emeritus at University of South Florida, Dr. Knox's longstanding peace and anti-war activities began back in 1965 in opposition against the Vietnam War. In 2005, Knox founded the U.S. Peace Memorial Foundation, which he currently chairs. He is awarded the 2007 Marcella Prize for Psychology of Peace and Social Justice by Psychologists for Social Responsibility, recognizing more than four decades of outstanding contributions to peace and humanitarian assistance. After retiring from the university almost a decade ago, he discontinued his license as a clinical psychologist in order to volunteer full-time to help end U.S. war and militarism. You can learn more at uspeacememorial.org. This new book, just out, titled Ending U.S. Wars by Honoring Americans Who Work for Peace. Michael D. Knox, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here. Happy New Year, and thanks for having me here early in the new year.
I guess it's a good thing that you moved away from your previous vocation to work full-time on peace, because we need more people like you working full-time, round the clock, to end these U.S. wars. You go way back to Vietnam days. You got involved in anti-war movements, peace movements, nonviolence movements early in your life. How did that happen?
Actually, earlier than I ever imagined. On August 9th, 1945, the U.S. bombed Nagasaki, and exactly 9 months later to the day I was born. So I often wonder, I never had a chance to ask my parents, but often wondered, you know, did they hope for peace at that point? And, were they encouraged that it would be a peaceful world and, time to settle down, have a family and so forth? And I guess the United States decided not to choose peace, but instead choose war. In my lifetime, the United States has invaded, bombed, killed people in at least 30 countries. And those are the ones that make it to the newspapers. There are lots of clandestine operations. But we've killed millions of people. We've injured tens of millions of people. No other country in the world has done that much injury, creating so many refugees. And if you think about countries killing people outside of their borders, all countries put together don't equal the damage that the United States has done.
It's actually very alarming, particularly putting it in historical context, going back to the ending of World War II, sparking the so-called atomic age, the Cold War, which historically hasn't seemed to have really ended. It kind of morphed and rebooted through the so-called war on terrorism, which of course has turned out more to look like a war of terrorism. You compile this annual report, really. You have an amazing database honoring Americans who work for peace. That's the subtitle of your book. Obviously, you've been very informed and moved by social justice concerns, issues of inequality, issues of mass violence, and you've clearly wanted to do something to change that. How did that direct you into creating this amazing resource?
In 2005, I took my son to Washington, D.C. He had just graduated from college, and I'd been going there on a regular basis because of grants, federal grants that I had. This was the first time I was a tour guide. And I recognized as I was walking around the city and trying to show him the city that I'd been to, that it was full of war monuments and monuments to wartime presidents. And even if the individual depicted in the statue was not being honored for war, they were holding a pistol or a rifle or a bow and arrow or a spear or some weapon, or the monument was surrounded with cannons or artillery pieces. And it just gave me a different perspective on Washington. And I wanted to tell him about my anti-war efforts, but there wasn't an appropriate place. And I was thinking during that visit and afterwards that there should be a U.S. peace memorial to honor the Americans who have done significant things to oppose war, especially U.S. wars. There was nothing like that. There was no appropriate place for me to discuss my activities with him, my anti-war activities, and the people just weren't being honored. I asked my son about his history textbooks, and basically they never discussed the anti-war movement or anyone who worked for peace. It was just war to war to industrial revolution to war to civil rights and more war and Cold War and the space race.
I'm a history professor. Back in graduate school, we used to joke, not funny, that the history department was actually called the War Department. All the classes we had were history of the Civil War, history of the Revolutionary War, history of World War I, history of World War II, the Vietnam War. Like half the curriculum was warfare, which led me to do a lot of my graduate work on the Kent State shootings that happened about 8 months before I was born, and really charted that trajectory in terms of asking the bigger questions of what kind of culture do we have? And what kind of culture do we want? It seems commonsensical on one level, but your tour of Washington, D.C., you saw quite clearly what we celebrate in this culture, war and destruction.
War and destruction. You don't even have to go very far back when you think of Joe Biden, both of his presidential acceptance speech and his nomination speech ended with the words, "And may God protect our troops." Clearly, militarism and war is on his mind. Donald Trump usually ended his speech with, "God bless our great military." That is our culture. That is the war culture of the U.S. Not only do we invade countries and kill millions of people and do other clandestine things, as well as sanctions that kill people. It's not just dropping bombs, but there are lots of other ways that we kill people. And I remember President Obama, whenever he would see someone in uniform when he was addressing a group, or he would ask, if he didn't, are there any veterans in the audience, ask them to stand, everyone would applaud, and he would point at them and say, "You're true American heroes, the best this nation has to offer. Thank you for your service." Not often, maybe during COVID, we're seeing a little more of thanking the healthcare workers, but you don't see our government interested in thanking teachers and healthcare workers and tradespeople and salespeople and all the people who contribute to make our communities function. It's all about war and it's all about soldiers. That's how we spend our money. That's how we spend our time. So the idea was to try to create some role models. We weren't reading about them in history books. So ending U.S. wars by honoring Americans who worked for peace is about honoring those people. So we can show them as role models by documenting specifically in great detail what they've done to oppose war, so that others might pick up these actions and emulate them and carry on the good work. The reason we have the U.S. Peace Registry, which is a big part of the book, is to reinforce this kind of behavior by honoring it.
Indeed, Michael Knox, you start the book, you outline a brief history of the culture of war, which is very well cited and includes a lot of amazing information. I'm glad to say that I do teach most of this stuff in my U.S. history courses, but again, thinking back to my college days, there's a lot of things in here that just weren't part of the course, weren't part of the curriculum. In fact, in many ways, unless a professor, someone with perhaps a similar background to you, really wanted to bring that into the classroom, a lot of the textbooks did a lot of the glorification or a lot of covering up. You've got an amazing list here, a very important list of U.S. wars since the end of World War II. I'm delighted to see that you also include Brown's, the Watson Institute's Cost of War Studies and Analysis here. I'm also happy to see that you mentioned the Kellogg-Briand Pact, going back to 1928, which I teach about often, but most people have never heard of it. And that, I guess, underscores even more of what your message has been here, that
war is illegal.
It was illegal. People were so traumatized at the end of the Great War, World War I, they weren't cynical enough at the time to call it World War I, because that would meant next time it'd be bigger and worse. And it was. But at the time, the Great War inspired a whole generation of people to try to figure out diplomatic ways through the League of Nations, which failed. U.S. didn't join the Kellogg-Briand Pact. But, and this is something that your project seems to really honor, it's that even though the United States does function as a culture of war, there are so many more layers and dimensions of so many amazing people that have fought for a culture of peace. It's what do we choose to focus on? And it's a delight to see a project like yours focus very specifically on honoring movements for peace and nonviolence. Why don't we talk a little bit about that? Because your first chapter is on a culture of war, and then you move into what you call a culture of peace and speaking out. Can you tell us a little bit more about what this culture of peace looks like? And then we want to, of course, go more and talk about your foundation, these awards, and the registry. Michael Knox.
The U.S. honors its military. We always reinforce warrior behavior. Holidays, ceremonies, parades, Hollywood movies, TV shows, memorials to soldiers, as I said, wars, and memorials to wartime presidents. And the militaries and military veterans enjoy, you know, medals, promotions, vanity license plates, tax exemptions, other privileges, all kinds of privileges and honors. Because of my age, when I grocery shop, people will often say, well, are you a veteran? Because that's a discount. And I say, yes, I'm a veteran of the anti-war movement. That just stops them, perhaps makes them think a little bit about what they're doing. But that's what we need to do. Your history class should use my book as a textbook, because here are real life examples. And I wrote it in a way that it could be used, portions of it, as a textbook. Changing the culture, what we have to do are recognize the role models, document what they've done, reinforce what they've done, start asking why they aren't being recognized. When we're asked, say, at a basketball game or a civic meeting of some sort, to applaud the veterans who stand up, we should be asking, let's applaud the teachers and let's applaud the healthcare workers and the people who make our country work. As I said, the tradespeople, the scientists. Let's pick a different group each time. Delta Airlines, one of many airlines that always boards the soldiers or the veterans first. I suggested to them in several letters that if they want to honor people and give them this special privilege, they should change it from week to week. One week it's teachers, the next week it's salespeople, the next week it's people working in grocery stores, whatever they want to do, but move it around, because all of these groups of people are important. And certainly peacemakers need to be recognized in this way as well. And that's what we're trying to do.
I'd like to remind listeners, you're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Right now, I am speaking with Dr. Michael D. Knox, and we're speaking about his recent book, Ending U.S. Wars by Honoring Americans Who Work for Peace. We'll continue our conversation after this brief musical break. Stay with us.
Now I've been crying lately, thinking about the world as it is. Why must we go on hating? Why can't we live in bliss? 'Cause out on the edge of darkness, there rides a beast train. Oh, beast train, take this country. Come take me home again. Oh, beast train sounding loud.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we are honored to welcome Dr. Michael D. Knox. His recent annual work is called Ending U.S. Wars by Honoring Americans Who Work for Peace. Michael Knox is the force behind the U.S. Peace Memorial Foundation, and his work has received accolades and attention from Code Pink's Medea Benjamin, noted activist and scholar Noam Chomsky, Kathy Kelly, Cindy Sheehan, David Swanson, so many familiar names to us here at the project and to our audience. And again, it's fantastic to be speaking with Michael Knox about this annual book. Talks about a registry for peace, and it's titled Ending U.S. Wars by Honoring Americans Who Work for Peace. Before the break, Michael Knox was talking about a history of the United States and a culture of war as opposed to a culture of peace. And of course, in the U.S., Michael, we declare war on everything, except Congress doesn't declare war anymore. We declare war on teenage sex. We declare war on drugs. We even had a war on poverty for a minute, that was actually working until Nixon stopped it. We have war against a virus. You know, our culture is just filled with war metaphors. And as you mentioned, your tour of Washington, D.C., seeing this jingoistic culture on full display. And you question, well, what happens if we honor other things and other people in our culture? Because we are not only a belligerent culture. There are many of us, clearly, you and all the people in your registry and all of the amazing organizations that work tirelessly for peace and to end conflicts. It's really amazing work. So let's get into this a little bit more, into what actually the registry is. You're working toward a culture of peace that you write. And then in your book, several chapters in the middle, you talk about people that have made a difference for movements of peace. You talk about organizations. But in chapter 3, you also talk about the National Monument for Peace. And of course, former Congressman Dennis Kucinich would often say that we need a Department of Peace, not just a Department of War that switched over to a Department of Defense after World War II. Can you talk about your push for this movement for a national monument? And then let's get into the people and the things that you celebrate. Michael Knox.
Thank you again for having me on. The U.S. Peace Memorial Foundation has basically three projects. One is the U.S. Peace Registry, which documents the work of hundreds of individuals and organizations in behaviorally specific terms. We found actually about 900 behaviors that people have engaged in, and we want to share those with other people. It's kind of a broad range of things people might do to oppose war, everything from one end of the spectrum, perhaps writing a letter to the editor, their local newspaper, perhaps holding an anti-war sign or attending a government-approved protest or parade or funding a billboard or funding any anti-war activities, through a spectrum that moves to civil disobedience, things like blocking traffic or interrupting Congress or chaining yourself to the White House fence. I mean, there are all kinds of behaviors. As I said, well over 900 specific things that people have done, writing books and articles and giving speeches, introducing legislation to Congress, speaking before the UN, all kinds of activities. So if you're someone who opposes war, but not sure exactly what to do about it, the registry contains lots of role models, hundreds of them, and lots of activities you can look at and say, well, I feel comfortable doing this kind of thing. And maybe you could do it yourself or organize some people. Some are individual activities, some are group activities. So that's one project, the U.S. Peace Registry. The second project is that our founding members, and I should say we have over 400 founding members representing 44 states, the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. We're just missing 6 states at this point. And the founding members, who number well over 400, nominate from the registry people to be considered for the U.S. Peace Prize every year. So every year we get lots of nominations and we publish those and we get lots of feedback. It's kind of a vetting process. And then we make the decision about who's to win the U.S. Peace Prize. And we've done that now for many years. And I think we have 12 recipients so far on an annual basis. And they include people you know and you've mentioned, like Cindy Sheehan and Dennis Kucinich and David Swanson and Medea Benjamin and Veterans for Peace. Code Pink won the U.S. Peace Prize. Jamu Baraka, Christine Ahn won it 2020. Kathy Kelly, who you mentioned, won it. Anne Wright, who I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with. Chelsea Manning, Noam Chomsky. These are people over the course of giving this award that we felt had made significant contributions to ending U.S. wars. So the third project is the building of a monument, a national monument called the U.S. Peace Memorial that we hope will be in the National Mall. It will be a large, architecturally interesting structure that people will gravitate towards, and it will contain all of the information in this book. In fact, until the U.S. Peace Memorial is built, this book is the U.S. Peace Memorial. That's because the monument will have kiosks all around it on the ground level where people can read about the people who are in the U.S. Peace Registry. So let's say you have a grandchild and take them to Washington after this is built, and you say, well, let's see what Grandpa did for peace. I hope and I invite you to be listed in the U.S. Peace Registry. You certainly should be there, and I'll tell you about the application process. It's on our website, uspeacememorial.org, to give us the details, all the specific details, not just I demonstrated against the war or I protested this, but specifically what you did. So these kiosks will be something that will make you an instant role model when you come up and say your name and up comes your face and all the things that you've done for peace. The people who have been awarded the U.S. Peace Prize will be honored at a higher level, actually engraved into the stone. And then there are 12 facets or walls to the project, to the peace memorial that we plan at this time. It will be covered with quotations from famous Americans. And we hope this will help change our culture. If people, especially young people, come up there, they will have heard of Albert Einstein, and they'll have heard of Margaret Mead and Helen Keller, but they may not know of their strong anti-war statements that they've made. So we're going to have short, pithy quotations from these American cultural and leadership icons that will let people know that there's been a long history of anti-war sentiment in this country, and they should know more about that. So we've gathered a bunch of quotations. They're in the book. They've been well vetted and referenced. We know that these aren't fake quotes. You'd be shocked, for instance, Albert Einstein said, "But I believe that the killing of human beings in a war is no better than common murder." I mean, that is a strong quote. Martin Luther King Jr., we've got 8 or 9 beautiful quotations from him. Here's one. "It is not enough to say you must not wage war. It is necessary to love peace and sacrifice for it." Or Margaret Mead, "We must devise a system in which peace is more rewarding than war." That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to reinforce the anti-war behavior of the people we include in the U.S. Peace Registry.
And Michael Knox, you also quote people like General Dwight Eisenhower, who was president. "I hate war as only a soldier who has lived it can, only as one who has seen its brutality, its futility, its stupidity." I think it's really important to include these different and these diverse people with these different backgrounds talking about our belligerent and warlike culture and many, many challenges and problems that come with it. You quoted Thomas Jefferson, George Washington. This is kind of a hidden history, right? Or as Peter Kuznick and Oliver Stone would say, the untold history. It's real. It's factual. It's there. You've done an amazing job of documenting it, putting it in one place. We just now need to get it into the curriculum. And this is a fantastic vehicle, Ending U.S. Wars, this book of yours. And of course, the website, uspeacememorial.org. Again, I was going through the registry here. So many familiar names, but it was great to go through it. I learned so many more folks that I hadn't really heard about. And also, you have a section honoring organizations. Can you talk a little bit about that?
We've awarded the U.S. Peace Prize to two organizations, Code Pink and Veterans for Peace. And there are many others listed. I'm not sure it's 100, but maybe 80 or so. And we document their activities and their actions. And you can go to our website. You can actually click and learn about the various activities that the organizations are engaged in.
Michael Knox, I'm definitely going to be including this registry and the website in our Intro to Social Justice Studies course.
Thank you.
This is an amazing resource, such a great educational tool. If only we could get more people thinking about our culture in ways that contribute to not just having a less violent culture, but just looking at things differently. So we have a couple minutes left here. We want to wrap up this segment, Michael Knox. But that's what I wanted to kind of end on is what exactly is I'm imagining what your goal is. But can you tell our listeners, what do you really hope to see come out of this project? And what have you seen change maybe in the last decade or so since you've been doing this?
Let me give you a Kennedy quote. I mean, Kennedy is not known as an anti-war person, but he stated that war will exist until that distant day when the conscientious objector enjoys the same reputation and prestige that the warrior does today. So substitute anti-war activist for conscientious objector, and you're talking about basically our mission. We're trying to make sure that they do have a high reputation and that people who oppose war are not looked down upon, frowned upon, considered anti-American or anti-military or even traitorous. There are consequences in our culture to speaking out against war. You might just lose friends or lose a job or a promotion, but you might also be arrested or beaten by the police or gassed or pepper sprayed. So we need to change the culture. And we see in my lifetime, I've seen significant cultural changes. We see them regarding civil rights issues, LGBTQ issues, women's rights. Many aspects of our culture are changing, and there's no reason why we can't move away from this war culture that's eating up all of our resources that we need for education, we need for healthcare, we need for disease prevention, we need to deal with the environment and climate change. We need the resources. They're at the Pentagon, they're in the CIA, they're killing people, and we need to bring those back to doing good.
Well, Dr. Michael Knox, thank you so much for joining us on the Project Censored show today. Thank you so much for the work you're doing with the U.S. Peace Memorial Foundation. The website is uspeacememorial.org. The book, the 2021 edition, now available, Ending U.S. Wars by Honoring Americans Who Work for Peace, an amazing registry, an amazing database, an amazing resource all around. Michael Knox, again, thank you so much for the work that you do, and we certainly hope to have you back on the program to talk about your amazing work.
Thank you, Mickey. I really appreciate it.
Special thanks to Laura Garano as well for connecting us.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaigns.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by myself along with Peter Phillips. I'm the executive producer, Mickey Huff, of this program. Also the host, Anthony Fest, our senior producer. Thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguised under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, far for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the ties for the master thief, confined, conquer, steal.